All right, welcome to More Score. This is an interview that I'm really excited to get to, and it's been on the calendar for a bit. We're joined right now by Colin Stetson, saxophonist, composer. New movie out is The Menu, which I'm really excited to see. Haven't seen it yet. And you also have a new album out, Chimera. Let's first off, welcome to More Score, Colin. Where are you joining us from?
I'm in Montreal at the moment. Just got back from the... going to see the New York City premiere of The Menu this week, and so back in Montreal for a second, and then going to head down to my studio in Vermont for a bit.
Nice. So I got to share this with you. So when we got reached out to by White Bear PR to talk with you, I was in Maui on my honeymoon on the road to Hana listening to Bad, Bad, Not Good featuring you.
Okay.
And I was like, no way. So I told Kyrie that that happened. And I was like, of course we got to talk to Colin. This is crazy.
That's
so
awesome.
Let's start with your background and your super unique playing style. Because when I listen to your solo stuff, it almost feels like I'm listening to someone paint. Like nothing's like inevitable. There's not like a constant, I know what to expect, like a normal song. And I find it super interesting. And it's, I know that there's some people that you model your playing style after, but it's not very common. So I'd love to start with your background and sort of how you found your way into your style of playing the saxophone.
Yeah, I don't know that there's any particular player who I model myself after. The saxophone I started playing when I was nine. Not because of any deep understanding or exposure early on to anything in the experimental or the avant-garde. It was quite the contrary. I was just, I was a child of the 70s. I was an MTV kid. I remember sitting and watching, videos like Who Can It Be Now by Men at Work. And then just thinking to myself when I was five, that's the one, that's my instrument. I'm going to do that. And so it really was really my musical background at that point was really rooted in pop culture at the time and in a strong foundation of classic rock. I basically was raised on Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles and Jethro Tull. And so for me, the broader musical landscape opened up considerably and very quickly when I was about 15 and started studying music, privately on the instrument. So I went from being, in my estimation, a very mediocre player, but I suppose with promise that my teacher at the time could identify, and he kind of whipped me into shape over the course of a year and a half from being that into, scholarshiped into school and competing and just playing. And at that point, I was just kind of a voracious listener, a consumer of all of music of all stripes. So I was.
And can I pause you real quick? Where were you at the time? Where were you? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. And so at that point, ears started opening up to different kinds of music, obviously to the avant-garde of my instrument, but just to everything across the board. And in my estimation, I'm as like the solo music probably came as much from like the earliest iterations and the earliest inspirations for it came from trying to emulate with my instrument the things that I was really excited about, like the playing of Jimi Hendrix, the electronic music of Nobukazu Takamura, for example. These things were some of the things that the cross-pollination, I think, was the most informative for me in those early years and kind of put me on a different path, because it, when you try to, emulating, I found early on that emulating saxophonists although I don't want to say it's quite easy, it's accessible, and you could hear in the playing and the sound of someone playing on your instrument, you have enough of an understanding, like a physiological understanding and relationship with it, so that you know on hearing what it is that they're doing to get it. And maybe it's just a question of practicing in order to teach your body to do it, but you can hear how it's being made. But when you hear sounds being made on other instruments, there's no direct through path to that emulation. You have to experiment, you have to find your way to something, and the approximation usually ends up with something quite novel. And so that's where most of my music, I guess, initially comes from.
And when you're talking about like trying to make the saxophone sound like a Jimi Hendrix style playing, but breathing is part of that. You must go through breathing exercises or something, because listening to you play, it sounds like someone would pass out with how constant you're playing and for how long.
I have not passed out. That's one thing that I've avoided. I talk with other sax player friends of mine about that, and I have friends who've dropped on stage, but never for me. And it's circular breathing, circular breathing is a technique. It is akin to balancing on a bike, I guess. It's a question of coordination. And so once you get it, once you find that equilibrium and more or less trick your body into allowing you to do it, it's there. And it's the fact of being able to breathe that way only really unlocks that one thing. It just lets you do that, but it doesn't account for any of the other things, which are actually the real feat. So you can circular breathe, but if you don't have the stamina or musculature in your embouchure to be able to hold a note beyond 30 seconds, then it doesn't matter if you can breathe continuously, because the rest of your body won't allow you to hold that, won't allow you to do anything useful with it. So,
And for the uninitiated, which I sort of am, circular breathing is this idea that you have wind, you have air that is constant, that is able to basically come in at the same time that it's also being used to then generate sound on the instrument. Theoretically, it could be forever, I guess. If your muscles or whatever were strong enough, right? Am I understanding this correctly?
Certainly. So circular breathing is one of the oldest techniques. I imagine that the practice of it in sound production probably predates languages, like modern language. It's something that goes far, far back, and I assume really has something to do with our ancestors' initial forays into the first attempts at communicating, existing in conversation with nature on an equal footing as nature, that ever presence. And so you can see this in virtually every ancestral population throughout time has some form of drone music. Bagpipes are pretty ubiquitous, some kind of thing like that. So all that circular breathing is really is a bagpipe without the bag. So you're using, if you understand the principle of a bagpipe, where you have a bellows to pump up a bag, that bag then the pressure being forced through reeds is what creates the continuum, and you just need to continue to put more air to replenish the air in the bag. The bag keeps the pressure on the reeds. So this and this become the bag. Reed is in the instrument, and the pressure it takes there is not just, I mean, you instead you have to create the seal with your musketeer, with your embouchure. And that's what gives you the potential for that ever presence for going. And so you can see that pop up, the most, like literally, the most literal example of that, that I know of, and it's kind of a glaring example that comes out of, if you look at the kind of arc and lineage of bagpipes throughout, like you say, the Mediterranean and up through, Western Europe and Scandinavia, you've got, in Sardinia, they made a type of bagpipe that's bagless. It's called a Launedas. And Launedas is really just, as far as I understand, there, it came out of a period of not having the livestock it took to fashion the bladder. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, then people figured out in a new way to go about it without having that, which was forego the bag, turn your face and neck into it, and just simply play these canters. It's a gorgeous instrument. And, but it is kind of like a very pure example of what it is that all of these things are doing fundamentally, and then what it is that we can do, learning from the basic principles.
Any bar tricks that develop from this? Is there anything outside of music that you can do at a party or something?
Sadly, there's virtually no other applications for it.
Dang, I was thinking there's got to be something.
No. And there's, I was talking to a friend recently about it because he was asking, because everyone's always told, as a means of practicing it, use a straw in a glass of water and try to, you know, make continuous bubbles, which I never thought was a very good way of teaching, because you can kind of approximate that without actually circular breathing, because who's to say when the bubbles stop, but I suppose the closest thing that there is to a bar trick, but this is a sad bar trick that's not going to it won't be winning you any fans, you take a square of tissue and put it on the wall. This is a better way to learn, because it'll force your mind into externalizing the act. Put on a wall, get close to that wall, get close to the, and then start circular breathing, start breathing onto it, and make sure that it does not fall. And usually that's the one I think that can click in people's physiology, because you're getting your mind off of what's going on in your nose and in your breath and in your lungs. You're putting it onto this piece of paper that's outside of you. And usually that's when we can unlock some things, when the necessity is externalized.
That's so interesting. That would be impressive. I feel like if someone just blew on a paper on a wall for like 30 minutes, I'd be like, that guy's, I need to be friends.
Yeah, they
would
kept only want to see minutes. It once.
Yeah. Yeah, you gotta go to different bars every weekend. We get it. You can keep it. Yeah.
So moving through your career, so you grew up in Ann Arbor. Did you go to the University of Michigan?
I did, yeah. The classical saxophone program there at the time was under the professorship of Donald Cinto, who's one of the premier, not only premier, I mean, he's one of the best teachers of the saxophone that have ever lived. Cause I mean, since the invention of the instrument, but he's also, he's a top handful of players of it. It's just an amazing, unique sound and an amazing professor. So I went to study with him and, primarily classical, study, but I did play and study a lot of avant-garde music, experimental music, free improvisation, jazz, whatnot.
So what brought you, what was the next step then? Were you in a band? Like, how did you move on from, all right, I graduated, I'm out there now. What was the next move for Colin?
It's a lot less, I think, as when any one of us thinks about what it was, well, that life was. It, I feel like it's a lot less linear in that sense, or compartmentalized, maybe. So mine never really seemed like that. I came in on this thing gradually over the course of my university years. I was playing, by the time I graduated, my friends and I, who, you know, we populated, you know, just a half a dozen or more different bands, most of us in a number of them, and we were playing every night of the week. And so rehearsing every day, going to school, still playing every night somewhere, tours, short tours happening. And so by the time I graduated, it was already pretty much transitioned into this lifestyle of permaplaying, just out there and in all different ways. I mean, playing with bands that were decidedly more kind of avant jazz, acid jazz type things at the time, or much more in the singer songwriter, or more straight, jazz and free jazz. And so those things, kept, kind of blended straight through my 20s. I moved from Ann Arbor. I moved to San Francisco, and I was there for about 6 years. And it really was just a continuous haul, just this inertia of playing, just always taking every opportunity, playing in just countless groups, and eventually to New York, where that continued. And that's, I think that probably, if I mean, not to gloss over all those years, but while I was doing all of this, kind of this endless hustle, playing with everyone, I was already performing solo probably twice, two or three times a year. And that started to build up. And I finally was approached by someone who wanted to put out a record of the music, and this, which ended up being the volume one, the New History of Warfare volume one that I put out, I think in 2007 or so. And so at that point, I remember sitting down with my best friend Stuart and talking about just how I didn't know how to get it all done. And I'd never really imagined any other way other than what I had been doing, which is to say it was just playing constantly with whoever, with all of the thing. There's so much music out there that is so worthwhile and fun to be a part of, to support and to play. And so this novel idea came out of his head initially, and he simply just said, okay, you don't have any time, quit all the bands except for the one that I'm in, and you still get to do that band, and otherwise you do the solo thing, you do that band, that's it. Tomorrow you call everybody, you say you're out, and then you just make that work. And so I did that, and it was the best thing that I had done. And not to say that I should have or would have done it earlier, but at that point it really was the perfect next step in my life and in relationship to my own music and to music in general.
What was your first kind of foray into providing music for something that is someone else's, visual artwork that they were working on? I should assume a short film of some kind.
No, actually, the first one was a feature, was called Blue Caprice, which I think I did around 2010. I'm pretty, 2009, 2010. And so Alexander Moores, the director, had heard my solo music, and for about 5 years, really, that was more or less what happened on a number of occasions. And so he heard my solo music, had found something in it particularly inspiring when he was writing the movie, and then thought that me and my approach would be good for the subject matter and for his storytelling. And so when he reached out, it was kind of out of the blue, and it was also kind of in the midst of one of the busiest, kind of most hectic times that I'd had, because I had just stopped. I think I was just on the cusp. I just released Judges, or was just about to release Judges of my own. I just finished, or was just on the tail end of finishing Arcade Fire Tours, just starting to record and then tour with Bon Iver. So it was just in this flux. So, the way that I've kind of taken most things in stride is that you don't say no to an opportunity. Something that's kind of being brought to you with open mind and with a kindness and with a kind of an inherent creative it was exactly how you want to be approached personally and specifically for your own approach, not would you like to get into this, do you think you could, your sound is particularly what I'm after. And so it afforded me a really perfect doorway into that world, and I loved it from the get-go. The combination of world building, storytelling, and also just the puzzling, the challenge of the puzzle of it all, of putting together a score. I find it incredibly satisfying. And so that was the first one. It was about probably 12, 13 years ago. And then they just kept on coming the same sort of way. I did a couple a year, mostly features, but a couple documentaries as well. And then I think I talked to Ari Aster in 2015. He reached out to me initially, 2014, maybe 2015, about Hereditary, sent me the script. I was the first person involved on Hereditary, just besides Ari. And then he said, okay, I'll come back at you as soon as I get funding. And he came back after, I think it was probably 2 years, and said, it's all together. Everything's a go. Are we good? You know, good to start. And so that was the best and the still the biggest runway I've ever gotten for a scoring job, where we had I started work on, it wasn't continuous work, but I started making music for Hereditary a year out from its premiere at Sundance. Wow. So yeah, it was awesome. And then so that premiered at Sundance in early 2018. And at that point, I think was that summer was when I also was making The First. And so in 2018, between the release of Hereditary and The First, I think that a lot of people went, oh, Colin Stetson just started scoring films. I had been in it for a while and learning, so, which for me was great, because had I just started in that year, I wouldn't have had all of the lessons learned, and just not only in terms of the particular all the particulars, the interface of working in that medium, but also the just process. Because it's enormously process oriented, and there are lots of things that, I imagine that most people are exactly like this, where we work very independently and very specifically and personally crafted. Like the way that I work is probably to any bystander probably absolutely fucking bonkers, but it works for me, and I imagine it is hugely time consuming, but it's the way that I like to work. It's very tactile. I have my hands on everything. There's not an inch of it that I don't touch. I've kind of thrived on that. I love the process and continue to.
You're a sax player. Do you play other instruments? Like, how do you sit down and write?
I play on the other instruments. So for example, on Hereditary, I played everything. I tend to play most of the instruments on my scores, with the exception of, so for something like Color Out of Space, I did all of the instruments on that except for the strings. And so I've been,
yeah, it makes sense.
Hugely fortunate to have an ongoing friendship and professional collaboration with my old friend Matt Combs, who is an amazing violinist who also plays viola, cello, upright bass, mandolin, guitar. And we were roommates in music school together. We've known each other for 30 years. And when it came time to do Color Out of Space, I reached out to him and him alone and just said, here, I've got this thing. It's going to be heavy strings. And I also work in a pretty, I want to work in a very direct way and be able to write in some maybe less conventional ways. And so I immediately just started. So the way that Matt and I have done this now for several years and on many projects is that I can write, conventionally with MIDI, with keyboard, and I can send him things like that. And of course he can listen to those parts and play them as they are. I can also write with my voice, which I do a lot of the time, where I will sing parts so that they can be a little bit more in line with how it is that I would express that part of my melodic persona. But also they can be quite non-intervallic, and they can be, so the parts can be quite aqueous and the counterpart can be very serpentine. And Matt is one of those brilliant ear players that can clone every part of that I send him precisely. And so I send him five parts of syrupy vocals, and he sends me back, 40, like a full orchestra that is completely cloned to that down to the microtone. And so we've had an amazing relationship in terms of that for years, and he remains one of the only people that I work with on a regular basis. Although for the menu, so the menu was all me, Matt on all the strings. Well, most of the strings. There's a couple of strings. The uglier strings are when you hear something that sounds really crass and disgusting. It's me. And then on some of the less obvious, more subtle, percussion there, Greg Fox, dear friend, Greg Fox is in there on the menu as well, especially in the very, very end. So when you see it, there's a whole build up at the end. There's a twinkling sort of pointillistic sheen that happens and gradually grows with the whole of it, and that's all Greg playing basically blast beats on water glasses, nice. And then at the during the credits he's finally able to, I think he's shredding on like a China cymbal alone in that last track during the credits. So
nice. Yeah. Well, let's get to the menu. I saw in an interview that you came on board in what you called the sweet spot. It wasn't too early. It wasn't super late. But I'm wondering, is it possible to get onto a film too early? Or why do you consider that the sweet spot?
Well, I think that's probably just something I said at the time. Is it possible to come in too early? I don't think it's possible to come in too early. It's possible to come in early and not have the time to do much about it, I suppose. But I always like the runway. So I'm working on something now that I've had a little bit of runway on. And so even though I've been in the middle of another project, I've done enormous amounts of legwork and have hours of music already, like sketches already there. So I already have probably all or most of the main themes, the bulk of a lot of the fundamentals written, and then the real meat of it will be when I start it up in, next month to implement that all with real instrumentation. So the sweet spot, I feel like I just never want to start later than that. I have, but I'm trying to never do that again. And sometimes you do it because it's just, there's something about the project that is just incredibly endearing, and I want to make sure that I get to do it. But for the most part, I think by and large, I would say that as a rule, I'm trying to never do anything in that last minute. I've been approached by big fucking movies, man. Like by things you would like blow your mind how some of these things that have pretty lofty budgets would turn around and come at music, which is not some insignificant part of
no
the,
overnight
the
feat,
finished
yeah.
project and no shit come at me like 2 weeks outside of when it was supposed to start and say then we've got a three and then we got a 3 week window where in which the music can start to be written and then end and needs to be mixed by, and so that's and if you look at that as an example, and probably not a ubiquitous but probably very off practiced example of how the whole thing works, you start to get a sense of why everything sounds, or why so much of it sounds so much the same. Because when you give somebody no time, what the fuck are they supposed to do besides, okay, you know, they're going to scramble. They're going to go for, cause you don't have time to cross temp. You don't have time to start getting inspired and going, oh, well, I know that they've been asking for this, but I've got another idea. And I wonder if this might work, if we can have a conversation. There are no conversations when you have 3 weeks to score the whole film. You just are cloning the temp and trying not to get sued. And so that's something I won't do because the alternative is just too good. When you have a good working relationship with directors and filmmakers who are open to new ideas, and when you have runway and enough time to play with it, it's really thrilling. It can be incredibly like joyous, the experience of putting together the music and making something new, trying to make something like tell a story in a new way that you haven't seen or heard before, and that to me is worth holding out for in all the different instances.
Well, the director Mark Mylod, which I hadn't heard his name, and I looked him up. He's directed and produced some of the most successful TV series in history, Succession, Game of Thrones, Shameless, Entourage, but he doesn't have a huge laundry list of big screen films.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, first off, how did he come to you? And also, what made you trust his vision, being that this is a new territory for him?
They came to me because I think a lot of my music started to get into the temp. And as it started to get into the temp and feel good, they started to think about reaching out to me. Now, they sent me a script and I read the script, and Will and Seth's script is awesome. It's one of the best, one of the two best scripts I've ever read. It's so fun. I won't get bogged down with the intense breakdown of how much I like that in all the ways, but suffice it to say, the script had me, and it was one of those that kind of wrote the music for me in a sense. It was so clear what it was that I wanted the music to do, and what it was that I thought that I could do for the film in a way that someone else wasn't going to. And so then Mark and me and Betsy got together and had our first meeting, and it was a combination of, those things are always a pitch. So I've got to figure out a way to tell them all the ideas I just had in the last 2 days, and in a way that more or less conveys everything to non-musicians as to how it's going to sound, like what it is that I want it to sound like. And so it was that, and they were entirely open and fond of all of the ideas as they came in. And at the same time, it was just incredibly warm and inviting and fun and funny. And I knew that we just all clicked personally, so that it was going to be a good and honest and clear thinking, clear talking sort of relationship with regard to making, doing some storytelling. So there was not any doubt in my mind about any of it. And Mark, he's just completely tested in all ways storytelling for so long. And then he's done it again, not only with all of his successes through Succession this year, but now with the Menu. He's done a brilliant job, and it's been just incredibly fun just to do the work with him.
As the first sort of reviews for a film come out, and it's getting a little weird now because everything's so fragmented and there's a lot of different pockets of people that love something or hate something or whatever. But do you know, coming into a project like this, like, damn, this is good. This is going to have like this is because a lot of people also, the job of a composer is to come in and make something better. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes you come in with something that might feel raw and then you can really refine it. But I'm wondering, once you understand the script being, really polished to begin with, then do you have a sense of like, this thing is, you know, someone can always screw it up, but this thing really has the potential to be a huge, you know, a sensation of a movie potentially.
I don't tend to think about things.
Okay.
I don't tend to think of things in terms of the reaction by the public or from critics. I don't bother myself with any of that because I actually find that it is quite not only a distraction, but it actually can just it can poison your future, your present and future honesty in terms of what it is, how it is that you work, how it is that you relate to your own creativity and process. So I don't pay attention to any of it on that level. So that said, I'm first and foremost reading a script and reacting to it and trying to gauge my reaction. Am I in it? Am I somewhere else? Just kind of, is this boring? Has it kept me? In what way has it kept me? Has it kept me in a way that this is gripping and I'm here, but I've seen that movie before. I've seen that story played a bunch of times. Yes, it's going to be a good one, but it's going to be a good version of a thing that I've already seen. So there's levels. And so for something like this, I've not seen this story before, and it's told in a way that is so impeccable. The writing is so impeccable, you know. Then on top of that, you have a director like Mark. Then on top of that, you have a cast like this, and so you pretty much no, you're not going to be. As a composer, yes, sometimes you are brought in and you look at what your job is going to be. And the job is, oh, well, the script was never tight enough. So your job is going to be to kind of try to pace this a little better.
Yeah, go fix it.
The edit's a little clunky. So you have to fix here, there, and the other thing. The scares never really came through. So now get ready to fucking support jump scares. Or here's some limb performances. So every time that person's on screen, you've got to. and so there are sometimes those things. This, you know, on its face has had none of those things. This was not going to be a me trying to fix anything movie. This was going to be a me getting to do exactly what it is I love to do. And that's just play and be there to try to hype it where, you know, just extending the existing brush strokes, you know, and it was exactly that. It was very fun.
We're a little long, so I just have one more question for you. When you read a script, how quickly do ideas pop into your head? Are you thinking of music while you're reading? Do you sit down and take it in and think of stuff after? Does it take a couple days? Like, what's that process for you?
it's pretty immediate, you know, like with the menu I had, I mean, I'll go back to something like Color Out of Space. I didn't even have that job yet, and I wrote the main theme. So I remember reading about that movie, that it was being made, and I went, what the? Like, really? And then I immediately just, I got out of the bathtub, went downstairs, and started fucking around on the Fender Rhodes. I was like, that's the main theme for that movie.
That's awesome.
Now I just had to go get it. So for the menu, I read the script, and usually what happens is I'll read a script, and then the next week or so, every morning I'll wake up and I'll go to the piano and I'll spend that first hour or two just coffee and initial ideas based on how it is I feel about the imagery that the characters, the character overall of what I feel like the film, the essence of it is like. And I'll improvise, find things that I like the feel of, and then kind of exhaust them, run them down and see, and then kind of play variations, permutations, and then record all of that to stream of consciousness. And so then I'll have these hours and hours of notes, and then, you know, I'll usually back off of it for a couple of weeks, come back, go in, refine. And so it's pretty immediate. A lot of it ends up like some of the stuff ends up being, a lot of it ends up being on piano in the very get go, but there's also other instrumentation where that script usually tells me what the overall instrumentation is going to be. Like, what is this thing going to sound like? And then, so that'll be the foundation. And then there's always some wild cards that come out later on, but more or less I know what the sound is and what I'm going to have to use to get at the majority of it.
That's so fascinating, because a lot of composers, some composers we talk to need to see picture. Some can read the script and feel that out. So it's always interesting how we're all human, but some people's brains need different types of, you know, need to be fed something to turn around and turn that into art. So it's fascinating.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm really excited to see this movie. The trailer looks amazing. The cast is amazing. Yeah. And I've heard your score, and I try not to listen too much, though, because I don't want to spoil anything and get used to the score. So I didn't dive in too hard, but it's a beautiful score. It's very classical and not a lot of electronics, from what I gather.
There's none.
There's none. Yeah. Okay. There you go. So we're looking forward to it. Colin, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you both.